You've heard plenty by now about the concerns over antibiotics. The drugs that cleared up so many infections in so many people over the years are losing their potency because the bacteria we use them on are developing immunity to the drugs. It is not hyperbole when health experts call those superbugs. Our guest this hour got to know one all too well. Stephanie Strathdee's husband, Thomas Patterson, nearly died from a superbug. It took a virus, a bacteriophage, to knock it out. That is the story Stephanie and Tom tell in their book, The Perfect Predator, a scientist's race to save her husband from a deadly superbug. Stephanie Strathdee is an epidemiologist and associate dean of global health sciences and director of the Global Health Institute at the University of California, San Diego. Tom Patterson is an experimental psychologist and evolutionary sociobiologist and a professor of psychiatry at UCSD. They got writing help from Teresa Barker in the writing of the book. Stephanie is our guest. Stephanie Strathdee, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Was phage therapy any part of your schooling, maybe the history part anyway?
Well, as a matter of fact, I took a virology class at the University of Toronto way back in the 1980s where phages were actually, you know, taught in class, and we studied them, but just briefly. I never knew that they were used ever to treat bacterial infections, but luckily I was able to hearken back to this old memory from my undergrad days, and it was really important in saving my husband's life.
It really was, which we'll get to in just a bit. Now, you and Tom work pretty closely together. Talk about your training, both of your training, and how your work together is so complementary.
Right. Well, I'm an infectious disease epidemiologist, so that basically means I have a PhD and not an MD. I know just enough about medicine to get me into trouble. My husband, Tom, is trained as an experimental psychologist. We've done HIV prevention research on the Mexico-U.S. border together for the last 10 years. We always thought that viruses were the enemy. Well, in this case, they turned out that the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Truly. So the story of his near-fatal illness starts in Egypt. Why were you both there?
We were on vacation. My husband's 20 years older than me. He has a bucket list, and he wanted to see the Valley of the Kings. And when he came down with this mysterious illness, I was teasing him, saying, oh, at this rate, you're going to see the Valley of the Kings feed first in your own tomb. But I didn't realize how close to the truth that was going to be.
Wow. A couple weeks later, what seemed like jokes at the time don't seem as funny, do they?
No. I mean, we can laugh about it now, but things turned very serious very quickly. And he went from being, you know, a really supremely hearty, healthy guy to one that was fighting for his life within a couple of days.
What were the first signs of trouble in Tom?
Well, we thought it was food poisoning. I mean, we'd had a seafood meal on a cruise ship, and we were, you know, in Egypt, so I just assumed that, you know, he caught a stomach bug because he eats more than me. And unfortunately, he didn't get any better after we called a doctor to the ship who gave him intravenous antibiotics and some fluids, and he said he'd be better soon, and he wasn't. In fact, he started complaining about his back, and I thought, you know, I had been going through my brain, you know, thinking of all the different microbes that could be causing this food poisoning, and then I realized, wait a second, back pain doesn't, you know, factor into an equation like this. And so I called a friend back home who is the head of infectious diseases at UC San Diego, and he said, hey, you know, you got to get this guy to a hospital ASAP. And there was no hospital. It was a clinic. So we did the best we could.
So you mentioned in the book that Tom's work, which includes fields that I'd never heard of, like psychoneuroimmunology, gives him a novel view of getting sick. What is that view?
Well, I think, you know, he is actually a world's expert in schizophrenia, and he'd always assumed that he understood what psychosis was and that people could tell the difference in their minds and their brains. And he had a lot of hallucinations, and they're included in our book. They're really fantastical. But they looked like everyday, you know, you and me sitting there, and he couldn't tell reality, you know, from his hallucinations and dreams. Some of this was from the toxin, from the bacteria, heavy sedation. But you also get what's called ICU psychosis when you're in the hospital for a long time. You can't tell day from night. And so he really, you know, was crazy for a while.
Yeah, the ICU psychosis, that was something new to me as well. We'll talk about some more of that later on as we get into the ICU. I want to cover some of the details up front again still, though. This is interesting because one of the things that you were told early on was that if, in fact, Tom had gotten one of the superbugs like MRSA from natural environments, those can apparently still be treated with antibiotics?
Yeah, both Tom and I had been swimming in the Arabian Sea in Goa in the mid-2000s, and we both broke out in these terrible green pustules that ended up being MRSA. And so the same doctor that helped us with Tom's superbug infection helped us with MRSA. And, MRSA is often acquired in clinical and hospital settings, but can be acquired from the environment as well. And increasingly, it is another superbug. It was the first one to be discovered in 1961.
Wow, that long ago. I didn't realize it was that. Wow, that's amazing. So nearly 60 years of MRSA, which is methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus?
Yeah, that's right. Very good.
Okay. Yeah, but we've been covering it for a long time too, obviously. So, in Tom's own situation, was it believed to be a MRSA thing, or was it something? I mean, you mentioned he was still barfing 24 hours after he'd last had food. His stomach distended. His back aching. At that point, what was the suspicion about his ailment?
Well, the doctors in Luxor diagnosed pancreatitis, which is an inflammation of the pancreas. But it turned out that was just a symptom for some other things. He had a gallstone that lodged itself in his bile duct and caused a giant abscess to form. And we thought, okay, well, we can deal with that. But, even that in itself is life-threatening. But what we didn't know at the time was that a superbug had moved into this abscess. We'd made this nice, cozy little apartment for it. And as we threw antibiotics at him, it killed everything else in his system and made this nice little home for this superbug that was resistant to all of those antibiotics.
Oh, so you made a petri dish inside your husband, you're saying?
Yeah, it kind of feels that way looking back on it, but it wasn't MRSA. It was something more deadly. The real name is Acinetobacter baumannii, but most people call it Arachibacter because so many veterans come back from the Middle East with this particular pathogen.
Okay, more about Arachibacter and how it was eventually treated by The Perfect Predator, the title of the book by Stephanie Strafty and Thomas Patterson. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange, and you can join us in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. We're getting details on a really strange medical case that was very much right up in front of Stephanie Strafty, our guest, because her husband, Thomas Patterson, looked like he was going to die from a superbug. And what ended up saving him was the introduction of a virus that could work against the bacteria. That is the title character in the book, The Perfect Predator, A Scientist's Race to Save Her Husband from a Deadly Superbug. It's by Stephanie and Tom with help from Teresa Barker. You can join us on the exchange as we talk to Stephanie, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So you mentioned that the gallstone was really a problem. You got stuck in the bile duct?
Yes, that's right. That's what got it all started. So, but really, this superbug was what was taking him down, and we were kind of blindsided by that. And by the time he was medevaced home to San Diego, it was resistant to all antibiotics in modern medicine.
Wow. And believe me, you threw some, was it colistin? What's the story on colistin? I want to get into that.
Yeah, colistin is actually considered the last resort antibiotic. It was developed in World War II, and it's incredibly toxic, but it can work under certain circumstances, but even Tom's bacteria became resistant to colistin.
Wow. So you had Tom airlifted from Egypt to Germany, which it sounds like it took a lot of work to set that up. What'd you have to go through to get that?
Well, luckily I had travel insurance through the University of California where Tom and I both work, and it cost $38, and it was the best $38 we ever spent. It paid for 7 ambulances and 2 Learjets to get him home.
Wow. So, but just getting to Germany, is that where the initial diagnosis, where it was realized what you had going on in there?
Yes, that's where they told me that he had this giant abscess and that the fluid inside it was brown, murky, and putrid, and had been there for a while, but that something now was growing in it, and they cultured it, and 2 days later it came back as the worst bacteria on the planet, as how it was described to me.
Had you heard of, let's try this again, Acinetobacter baumannii, had you heard about it before?
Yes, I had. Initially, it didn't ring a bell, but when I saw it written down, I remembered that it was a bacteria that I used to streak on my Petri plates back in microbiology class in the 1980s. And then we didn't require any special handling, just a lab coat and gloves. So over the last couple of decades, this bug has become somewhat of a bacterial kleptomaniac. It steals antibiotic resistance genes from other bacteria and has become the number one public enemy on the World Health Organization's list of the 12 most deadly superbugs to human health.
I guess that alone is amazing, the things that it's capable of doing. But then when you talk about the clinicians you're dealing with here who are saying things to you that clinicians generally don't like to say, like your husband has the worst bacteria known to humans.
Absolutely. This particular organism was responsible for closing several ICUs and hospitals across Europe. It was also implicated in an Olympus scope scandal that, is inside medical equipment. Bacteria can hide, and this one is particularly good at doing that. So it's become a really terrible organism, and it's also used the whole military medevac system to kind of, propagate itself. So it's most commonly acquired in clinics and hospitals these days.
So you mentioned that it's also called the Iraqi bacter. So it came back with a lot of troops from Iraq, too?
Exactly. Iraq and Afghanistan. And many of these troops, were being treated for injuries like, shrapnel and bomb blasts, et cetera. And they might have recovered from those injuries, but then Iraqibacter, killed them.
How much had you known? I mean, you mentioned that when you saw it written down, you realized what you were dealing with here. But just in terms of your own work and your own career as an epidemiologist, how much had you dealt with it?
Well, not very much. I'm just, I dealt with it in my class in the 1980s, and I've been focusing my career on HIV, and I was kind of in my own world, and this whole superbug crisis, I knew was a problem, but I didn't realize how big a problem it was. In fact, the CDC and the World Health Organization say that the antimicrobial resistance crisis is a bigger threat and more immediate threat in our lifetimes than climate change.
Wow. That's saying a lot.
Well, yeah. I mean, by 2050, one person every 3 seconds is estimated to be dying from a superbug. Wow. Unless we do something drastic.
Stephanie Strathdy is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her husband, Thomas Patterson, nearly died from a superbug infection that ultimately was treated with a bacteriophage, which is the title character in The Perfect Predator, a scientist's race to save her husband from a deadly superbug. So obviously, as an epidemiologist and a scientist generally, you're trying to figure out and help the clinicians with treating your husband and to learn more about what it is that he's going through. But you're a human being too. So, I mean, you needed support. How long before you called in family, Stephanie?
Well, while he was in Frankfurt, it was clear that the complications that he had, even before we knew that he had a superbug, were very serious. So we called his daughters to bedside. They flew over from San Francisco, and he was able to rally. He had 7 cases of septic shock and was in the hospital 9 months for his illness. So we didn't realize that this was just the beginning of what was to become a marathon.
All right, so walk us through sepsis and septic shock and what those mean and what some of the implications are.
Well, sepsis is generally when a bacteria enters the bloodstream. Now, to keep in mind, I'm not a medical doctor. I've learned all of this by the seat of my pants and by sitting in the ICU and reading and seeing it happen right in front of my eyes. But we take people through that in the book because you learn with me about medicine. So sepsis happens when bacteria enters the bloodstream and the body immune system sees it as an invader and goes into overdrive. And so what you see happening is the heart rate increases, the respiration rate increases, the blood pressure drops, the person develops a fever. Often it's happening so quickly and so rapidly that they get the what's called rigors or the shakes. And I'm not just calling it a shiver when you have like a flu or something. The shaking is so strong that the bed frame often rattles. And in his case, it was hitting the wall. And, it can be fatal. About 50% of people die from septic shock when they have it. And so, it can be, a real problem. And in fact, when we were planning on phage therapy, that was what we were also worried about, that if we were going to be injecting viruses into his body, that we might kill him by trying to cure him.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, as we pointed out, that was a real Hail Mary late in the game. So let's talk about the things that happened earlier in the treatment. I mean, you mentioned earlier, I think, that even the antibiotics that you thought would work ended up killing the good bacteria and the bad stuff still hung in there?
That's right. And that's the problem with antibiotics. I mean, many of them are what we call broad spectrum. So they don't just kill one bacteria. They kill multiple kinds of bacteria. And, you know, that was could be seen as an advantage, especially early on when antibiotics were first being developed, because doctors could prescribe them without having a specific diagnosis of the kind of bacteria that could be causing the problem. But we know now that it has a downside in killing the friendly bacteria that exist in our microbiome.
So once the doctor comes out and says your husband has the worst bacteria we know of, it's just like public health enemy number one, and we're talking Acinetobacter baumannii. The infection control procedures, it sounds like, got even stricter at that point.
Absolutely, and it was really a great idea that they implemented them in the first place. I mean, I thought it was just being done for a precaution. But if this bacteria had spread to even one person in the ICU, the hospital would have been closed down. So we were really fortunate these infection control procedures were implemented. And, you know, it's only a bacteria that would be a problem to people who had weakened immune systems. But ICUs are full of people that are, you know, fighting, you know, with chemotherapy, et cetera.
Yeah, very weakened immune system. So what kinds of procedures did you have to go through just to spend time by Tom's bedside?
Well, certainly we had to wear gloves all the time, and we had to wash our hands twice before leaving the room. We had to wear a gown that was disposable. Every time we entered the room, we had to have a face mask, a gown, and the gloves. And, you know, everything basically that went in the room, had to be disposed of or, you know, sanitized to the extent possible.
There's a moment in the book where you were spotted by somebody in the hospital outside of ICU, and it sounds like that person was actually scared at seeing you.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Now that my husband has recovered, a lot of people don't want to shake his hand, even though he's been cleared of his superbug infection. And I think it's just, and some people, you know, didn't want to shake mine either. I think it's just a lack of awareness. And one of the reasons we wrote our book is to promote awareness of superbugs and potential avenues to solve the problem.
The book is called The Perfect Predator, A Scientist's Race to Save Her Husband from a Deadly Superbug. Stephanie Strathdy is an epidemiologist and the director of the Global Health Institute at the University of California, San Diego. Husband Thomas Patterson, who nearly died but fortunately did not, is an experimental psychologist and evolutionary sociobiologist. You can join the conversation here on the Jefferson Exchange. Questions about what Stephanie and Tom went through. Tom more than Stephanie, but Stephanie got to help figure it out. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3770. 60 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. There's some good history in The Perfect Predator, Stephanie. Alexander Fleming himself, who was the guy who figured out penicillin, made some warnings about antibiotics. What did he say?
Right. Well, right around the time he won the Nobel Prize with his colleagues for the discovery of penicillin, he warned people that misuse or overuse of antibiotics could promote resistance in bacteria. And his warnings went unheeded because we just thought, well, we'll just keep developing new antibiotics. And pharmas certainly were doing that for quite a while. But then it got super expensive to do that when you realize that the shelf life of an antibiotic might not be as long as you thought because of the resistance problem that is emerging, and globalization, and you know, our plane rides around the world are spreading, you know, these antibiotic resistance genes faster than we ever realized possible.
It's listed in here as a pull quote, but something that Louis Pasteur said about microbes as well.
Yes. In fact, you know, we've known now for decades that antimicrobial resistance can occur, but we just haven't really done anything about it. And in fact, just last week, you know, a Lord Jim O'Neill, who wrote a famous report, you know, projecting the number of superbug deaths, he said, look, pharma, you know, you really need to step up the plate and do something here because this problem is getting more and more dire.
And again, antimicrobial resistance, called AMR, as you mentioned, getting fairly widespread in the world today. You had mentioned medical facilities up to a point, but this is a fairly large issue because people go to hospitals with these bugs, and the hospitals then have a hard time getting rid of the bugs. Is it? So in that context, is there any way of knowing where Tom got his infection?
Well, we know now that it was an Egyptian strain because the organism was sequenced, but we don't know where he acquired it. It could have been anywhere. This was a fairly ubiquitous organism, but it could be that he acquired it in the clinic because that's where this organism is usually acquired these days.
So he might have had the gallstone, but without the superbug.
Right.
Yeah. I haven't mentioned this yet, but there's a thing early in the book about this space he went into in Egypt that was tight to get into, which I don't know. There's almost a sense of it kind of hanging over the experience in Egypt before you guys get out. What was the place he went into and the warnings about
it? It was a pyramid. It was actually the Red Pyramid close to Cairo. It's one of the only pyramids that you can actually crawl into. But in order to do that, you have to climb up this zigzag staircase. It's very steep, and climb backwards into the dark down 300 feet on very slippery, rickety stairs. And I didn't do it. But 2 days before he fell ill, that was Tom. He was clambering down there to explore the pyramid. And, it just kind of was a metaphor for the next 9 months of our lives.
Which is just amazing. So you mentioned that certainly later in the game he was getting, he was kind of losing it. But talk about, were there moments when he seemed to rally in Germany before he got airlifted to San Diego?
Yes, the arrival of his daughters really made a big difference, even telling him that they were coming. He seemed to have some hope. But when he asked me if he was going to die, I had to answer him and told him, look, he was very sick and that he needed to fight really hard if he wanted to live. And that wasn't the only time that we had a conversation like that. In fact, before I turned to an alternative therapy like phage therapy, I asked him if he wanted to live, even though he was in a coma.
And, he didn't give you a response at that point, but there were other times you had these discussions, as you point out.
Right, but he actually did squeeze my hand. So one of the lessons that Tom takes home from his experience is that just because you're in a coma, you're not a loaf of bread. You usually, can hear people, but it's kind of garbled. And so at the time, he thought he was a snake. We found this out much later when we were comparing our experiences. And so he said that, he wanted to squeeze my hand because I said, squeeze my hand if you want to live, but he didn't have hands. So it took him about a minute to wrap his body, as he described it, around my hand to squeeze it. Pretty crazy.
And Tom obviously writes a couple of the interludes in the book. Are these more or less what he remembers from his fever dreams when he was out?
Yes, he dictated those to me. He had a lot of PTSD, which is called post-ICU syndrome, and so his hallucinations would invade his dreams, and he would wake up in the morning, and he would relive them, and I would write them down, and I tried to make the most sense of them. Some of them are like parables. Others are very Faustian, one where he's on a spit looking down over what appears to be his image of hell. I mean, just horrific.
Well, hell was right in front of you as you were dealing with this. The book is called The Perfect Predator, A Scientist's Race to Save Her Husband from a Deadly Superbug. Stephanie Strathdee is our guest. Was there any recognized playbook for Tom's care by the time you got to San Diego, recognized that basically no antibiotics were working anymore?
Well, the doctors told me we had two options because this giant abscess in his abdomen was now, full of this superbug. And they said as long as it stays in there, maybe his immune system will kick in and fight it. But, we need to somehow get rid of this abscess. And so they said, well, we could operate and take it out. But because we have no antibiotics that will work, if he goes into septic shock, he'll most certainly die. So then they said, well, the next option is to poke holes in his abdomen and put catheters in there to drain out the infected fluid. And that's ultimately what we did. It's just that one day when he sat up in bed, one of those drains inside him slipped and poured all of that infected, gross, bacteria-laden, goop into his abdomen and his bloodstream. And so right in front of me, he went into septic shock. And then from that moment onward, he was dying a little bit each day.
So he had all this stuff inside him and you were trying to keep it contained.
Right.
Yowza. And obviously that failed over time. How high was his fever spiking, just out of curiosity?
Well, they went up to 104, 105 at various times. It was he was absolutely delirious, but he for a couple months he was in a coma and in and out of consciousness at some moments. But he was on a respirator because his lungs were failing. He was on three different heart medications called pressors to keep his heart pumping. And right before we got the phage therapy to him, his kidney started to fail. So that's multi-system organ failure. And I signed the consent form for kidney dialysis the day that we began the phage therapy. Nobody thought that he was going to make it.
Wow, yeah, if you got the kidney failure, you were getting really close there.
Exactly.
That's amazing. Wow. We'll get more details about how things finally took a turn for the better after many months. The book is called The Perfect Predator, A Scientist's Race to Save Her Husband from a Deadly Superbug. The perfect predator being the bacteriophage called in to, well, not called in. You don't actually call a bacteriophage, but you'll see how it was used in just a moment as we come back to the interview with Stephanie Strathdee here on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join us by phone and email 800-838-3860 and jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Stephanie Strathdee, The Perfect Predator, and you in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Thomas Patterson is an experimental psychologist and a professor of psychiatry at the University of California, San Diego, married to Stephanie Strathdee, an epidemiologist and director of the Global Health Institute at UCSD. They have written a book about what it was like to watch him get taken over by a superbug and ultimately get helped back to health by the introduction of a bacteriophage. It's a story told in The Perfect Predator, A Scientist's Race to Save Her Husband from a Deadly Superbug. It's by Stephanie Strathdee, Thomas Patterson, and Teresa Barker. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We had talked about, you already mentioned that it took 9 months for him to get healthy again. There's a moment in the book, though, when you're dealing with the, and it sounds like they were very honest doctors when you got him back to San Diego, but 5 weeks to recover for every week you spend in bed. So by that point, he'd been in bed for 5 weeks already, hadn't he?
Yeah. That's right. You know, you lose all of your muscle mass when you're just lying there in bed. You know, if you've had the flu and you're lying in bed for a week or two, you stand up and you're really stiff and you need to get your strength back. Well, imagine lying there for 9 months. So, but we believe that if Tom had had phage therapy earlier in the course of his illness, he could have walked from the hospital. But because it was an experimental treatment, it could only be offered when you had a dying patient who had no other recourse.
The right to try, as people talk about this. Before we get into the medical details, you probably are aware of the fact because you felt this in your own life. But just reading the details of the book, I mean, you go back and forth from medical fascination to going into tears because things were so bad. I mean, what were you and your family doing, Stephanie, to keep your own spirits up?
Oh, it was really difficult because, again, when we got back to San Diego, these are now my colleagues that were treating him. And that was both, a blessing and a curse because I was their professional colleague. So I had the wife me and I had the scientist me, and I felt like I was two people. Tom's daughters are my stepdaughters. They're adults, and they were there off and on as much as they could. They lived in the Bay Area at the time. And, it felt like every other day I was calling them up saying, please come, it's close to the end. And, it just was a roller coaster.
Tom, I was really surprised to see that there were episodes when he actually got well enough to get out of the ICU for a while. Is that what happened?
Yes, that was before his drain slipped, and when they were, hoping that as long as this bacteria stayed in this abscess in his abdomen, that he would be able to get stronger. And in fact, he was for a time, but then, once this superbug got out and fully colonized his body, it was, the beginning of what was almost the end.
Fully colonized means what it sounds like, doesn't it? The bacteria had just taken over. They were everywhere in his body?
Everywhere. So they entered his bloodstream, they were in his sputum, and multiple tissues. So that's when we realized that any treatment that we were going to give him had to be intravenous because we really needed to ensure that there wasn't a hidden reservoir of bacteria that could become resistant right away.
All right, so that's what the intravenous does. It just makes sure it gets to all the nips and tucks in the body?
Yeah, well, we're not really sure of how the phage know where to go, but at least, you know, nature's smarter than us, and we can leverage it to our own abilities.
So talk about how the phage therapy got in here, because it sounds like you did a web search for alternative therapies and didn't find many.
Right. Around the time I started looking for alternative treatments, I got an email from my friend Maria Ekstrand, who's a professor at University of California, San Francisco. Maybe she's listening. It was just very fortuitous because she said a friend of hers had gone to Tbilisi, Georgia, to get phage therapy because, as you pointed out earlier, phages had been discovered in 1917. They had been used for treating bacterial infections. And when penicillin came on the scene, the West kind of forgot about them and thought these phage things are too finicky. But they were taken up very robustly in the former Soviet Union. So that's where they're used as standard of care. And so my friend had written me saying, you know, this worked for a friend of hers. And I had just stumbled across this paper saying that phage therapy could be used to treat Tom's bacterial infection. So I got really excited and contacted my colleagues at UC San Diego who were treating him, and I said, could we use phage therapy to treat Tom?
And what was the initial response?
Well, I got an email right back from Dr. Chip Schooley, who played a really seminal role in making this happen. And he said, you know, this is an interesting and intriguing idea. If you can find phages that can match Tom's bacterial isolate, I'll call the FDA and get approval for compassionate use and give it a whirl.
So that's a key question then. I mean, how do you, first of all, who would have them? And second of all, how would you choose which ones to use given what he was infected with?
Well, those are the questions I was asking myself at that exact moment because, of course, I'm not a phage expert and had really very little knowledge of these. So I went back to the internet and I made a list of researchers that were studying phage and seemed to potentially, based on their research, had phages that were active against Tom's Acinetobacter baumannii. And I wrote them, total strangers, sent them a picture of Tom lying there in a coma and begged them to help me. And one of them from Texas A&M, Dr. Rai Young, wrote back and said, you know, I would normally refer you to one of the few startups that's working in this area because they sometimes help patients. But in your case, he says, I'm the same age as your husband. You look like somebody who could cut through all the red tape to make this happen because this is, you know, going to take a lot of effort. And, you know, I'll turn my lab into a command center and see if I have any phages that match. So that's what he did. And one of his graduate students, she slept in the lab for weeks to make this happen.
So how long then between the time you thought this was a possibility to the time you actually got a chance to get them into Tom?
Unbelievably, it was 3 weeks. I sent my email on February 22nd of 2016, and we administered the first phage cocktail to Tom on March 15th. So you compare that to an antibiotic that takes, you know, 10 to 15 years to develop and, you know, $80 million or more. This is something that, you know, it's nature's own alternative to antibiotics, these viruses that naturally attack bacteria. We had to find the ones that were a match for Tom, and that was part of the struggle.
The phages are wild looking. I mean, I know we're looking at it from electron microscopes and things, but it looks like a light bulb with spider legs.
Yeah, that or something of like a lunar lander. Other people call them a living syringe. But there's lots of different sizes and shapes of these things. But the most common one is the one that you're describing that looks like a little bit like an alien spider.
Right. See, you mentioned cocktail, though. So it was more than just the phages going into Tom's bloodstream?
No, it was multiple phages, because if you only use one phage, then you're giving the bacteria a leg up to become resistant to it right away. So just like bacteria can become resistant to antibiotics, they can become resistant to phage. So the more phage that you have, ideally phage that are attacking different components or different receptors of the bacteria, the better off you're going to be. And that, you know, that problem of resistance was one of the reasons why phage therapy was forgotten as well. But the Navy got involved, and they also developed a phage cocktail for Tom, and they were able to show that even though Tom's bacteria did become resistant to the first phage cocktails, they developed a second-generation phage cocktail within a week. So that shows that you can use personalized phage therapy on demand.
Tom realizes that without being married to an epidemiologist, he'd probably be dead, right?
Well, let's just say he takes out the garbage now every time I ask him.
Well done. Here's a call from Mark in Reading. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Stephanie Strafty, the author of The Perfect Predator.
Good morning. What are the chances of phage becoming generally available medically in the United States?
Good question.
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. As a result of Tom's case, we've treated several other patients here at UC San Diego across the U.S. and internationally, and we've opened the first dedicated phage therapy center in North America called IPATH. It's the Center for Innovative Phage Applications and Therapeutics. We're working, like other researchers are, to move phage therapy into clinical trials. So if it's shown to be just as efficacious or better than antibiotics, it will have the opportunity to become licensed by the FDA, and it could be offered more generally to other people. And that's one of our goals here. We want to make it easier for people to get phage therapy. We realize that we're in a place of privilege. Without the resources and the networks that we had at our disposal, this wouldn't have happened.
How big an obstacle was the FDA? I mean, you mentioned that under what amounts to the right to try efforts, that because it was looking like Tom was on his way out, it was okay. But I mean, while the lab is working for 3 weeks on coming up with the right phage cocktail, what was the FDA doing? How long did it take to deliver its word?
Well, the FDA actually was the biggest help. You know, they have a reputation of being obstacles when it comes to new therapies. But when we contacted them and told them what was going on with Tom and that we wanted to try phage therapy, they were the ones that connected us to the military. We had no idea that the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Army were working on this. And so the Navy agreed to help. And so without the FDA, I don't know that Tom would have lived. The Navy's phage cocktail was extremely potent. They had a whole library and basically a walk-in cooler of phages that were already characterized.
Wow. So they were more or less ready to go. But did the stuff come from there or from the other lab?
Both, actually. The Navy's phages had never been used on humans, just mice and rats. So I was basically turning my husband into a giant guinea pig, and I knew it. But one of the innovations of his case was that we went intravenous. Even in the former Soviet Union and in Poland, where phages have been used for decades, most people are not treated intravenously with phage due to the risk of septic shock. So we were able to show that in Tom's case and several others since, that intravenous phage therapy is relatively safe, and the FDA is really helping to provide phage therapy even in cases that are not as life-threatening. So if you have a superbug infection that's resistant to all antibiotics, the FDA in general is approving these on a case-by-case basis.
Without intravenous, how would the phage otherwise be administered?
Well, administered them initially through the catheters or the drains in his abdomen to make sure that, you know, it was going to be tolerated. And then we went intravenous. In other cases, people with cystic fibrosis who often get superbug infections, they can breathe in phage through a nebulizer. Phage can be applied topically to boils on the skin. They can also be taken orally.
So obviously a couple of hundred pages of the book we'll have to skip here, but what? How long after the first time you administered the phage cocktails to Tom did you get a sense that maybe this was working?
Well, once the Navy phages arrived 2 days after the Texas phages, we injected those into his bloodstream on a regular basis, and he woke up 3 days later, lifted his head off the pillow, and kissed his daughter's hand. I mean, everybody in the ICU freaked out because, you know, the director of the ICU has since said, I've never seen anybody so close to death that made a full recovery.
Wow, that's amazing. So do you have a count of how many people came in contact with Tom during his trip through the various medical facilities in Egypt and Frankfurt and San Diego?
I don't, because many of these are teaching hospitals. Doctors are rotating. There's different specialties. It would have been hundreds, but so many people, and doctors and nurses who were the real champions and heroes here, have come to us and said that Tom's case has really changed the way that they practice medicine, that they never give up on a patient anymore, or that they know how important it is to touch your patients, because Tom really felt like he was a pariah.
Yeah, that whole thing about, like, don't come near me because I got the bad stuff in me.
Exactly.
So the question, though, because one of the major concerns here, of course, is that the bug he had has developed a resistance to antibiotics. And you mentioned already that bacteria can develop some immunization to phages over time. So are all remedies that we can come up with limited in time, it would appear?
Well, certainly antibiotics and phage are in, you know, the same ballpark as that bacteria have the opportunity to become resistant to them. But in the case of phage, you know, there's 10 million trillion phages on the planet. That's an estimate, but that's 10 to the power of 31. So you can just go out and get a second-generation phage cocktail that matches the mutant bacteria, and that's what we did in Tom's case. And that can be done relatively quickly. So imagine having an ever-expanding phage library. My dream would be to have an open-source phage library that is available to people, shared across, you know, countries and hospitals, to be able to respond not just to outbreaks but also to potentially bioterrorism threats.
All right, so a lot of work going on. And then finally, how is Tom doing? How big is he now?
Oh, he's great. He's still 100 pounds lighter. He has trouble putting on weight. I wish I had that problem. But he's back at work. We've been on vacation to Africa, South America, Canada. He's doing great. He's got a few dings. Mm-hmm. He's got some congestive heart failure, but anybody would be happy with where he is now.
Right, considering what the alternative was. What an amazing story. The book is called The Perfect Predator, A Scientist's Race to Save Her Husband from a Deadly Superbug. Thomas Patterson, the patient and co-author. Stephanie Strathdee, the author of the book. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
You're welcome.
All right, take care.